Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Shchepinchuk. Today's show is dedicated to the Israeli attack on Lebanon in mid-July 2006. We'll first feature an interview with Lena Ode, a foreign exchange student from Chicago at the American University in Beirut. We'll also feature an article by Larry C. Johnson, published on the blog Boomin Tribune, examining the situation from a wider perspective. We'll also include a selection of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes. But now, a selection of news headlines courtesy of The New Standard.
This is The New Standard radio news update for the week ending July 14th. I'm Catherine Kopp. Congress and the Bush administration may fail once again to reauthorize the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, one of the main funding mechanisms for native health care programs. The act expired in 2000, and 13 years after the last reauthorization, Congress has yet to renew it. Joe Finkbonner is executive director of the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board and member of the Lummi Nation in Washington.
This administration is treating the American Indian population as a special interest group and doesn't understand or refuses to understand the federal obligation that's there and just doesn't want to fund it.
When the federal government brokered treaties with tribes during the 19th century, it promised to provide health care and medical services in exchange for millions of acres of land. Since the act expired 6 years ago, Congress has been funding Native health programs through $3 billion in budget appropriations. But health advocates say that's only about half of what's needed. American Indians have some of the highest rates of chronic diseases, alcoholism, suicide, and mortality. A rash of recent shootings involving the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department has sent chills through local communities. As of July 12th, there have been 19 officer-involved shootings this year. That number already exceeds the total for all of 2005 and includes 10 deaths. Activists with the NAACP, ACORN, the ACLU, and others say that some of the recent shootings seem more a product of poor judgment by police than imminent danger from their victims. Will Ward is head organizer with the Nevada chapter of ACORN.
They result to force rather than trying to calm someone down and take control of the situation based on a greater understanding of this individual and the community that they come from. Because they don't have their relationships, it's less an individual or real person that they're dealing with and more just a suspect that they can, you know, shoot in the back if they need to.
The coalition is pressing lawmakers to strengthen the state laws governing the use of deadly force and to reform the public hearing process for investigating deaths at the hands of police. Meanwhile, youth and civil rights advocates across the country are speaking out against the rising presence of armed police working on school campuses, leading to what they call a school-to-prison pipeline. Damon Hewitt with the Legal Defense Fund, which recently released a study on school discipline in Florida, says schools and the police who work in them are turning to increasingly punitive discipline for minor infractions.
And to be clear, we're not talking here about children who are bringing guns and knives and drugs to school. It's not the activity that's changed among the students or their conduct. It's more our responses that have changed over the last few decades.
Hewitt said that like the U.S. justice system, Black and Latino youth are disproportionately affected. Youth advocates also say that a ballooning number of suspensions contributes to a push-out crisis, in which school officials force students out of the learning environment, sometimes even involuntarily transferring them to other schools. The top 1% of America's wealthiest citizens enjoyed an increase in income far greater than that of the rest of the population in 2004. That's according to a new report released by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. It concludes the income gap has grown sharply over the past 3 years and will continue to grow. The wealthiest also took 1/5 of the American pie. That's up 2 percentage points from 2003. The center also said the weak wage and salary increases, along with the rapid growth of corporate profits documented in previous studies, has contributed to the growing inequality. The Sierra Club has filed a lawsuit against the EPA for allowing large municipal waste combustors to continue to emit dangerous toxins, including dioxins, mercury, and lead. The EPA is required by the Clean Air Act to set maximum emission standards for the 162 waste combustors that burn municipal trash. But the Sierra Club says the EPA's final ruling is too lenient and doesn't follow the federally mandated regulations set out by the Clean Air Act. Earth Justice Attorney Jim Pugh said the EPA is throwing away an opportunity to ratchet down pollution. The new standard is a 100% reader-funded, independent, hard news website. To read full coverage of these stories and more by TNS journalists, go to newstandardnews.net.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The Federal Communications Commission has approved the joint purchase of bankrupt cable company Adelphia by the country's two largest cable firms, Comcast and Time Warner. The $17.6 billion deal will give Comcast and Time Warner control over half the cable subscriber base of the United States, with virtual dominance of the top 20 cable markets. While the FCC placed some conditions on the acquisition, mostly with regard to providing independent cable channels and sports networks access to various cable systems around the country, Comcast and Time Warner are free to trade Adelphia's various service territories between each other in order to strengthen their regional monopolies. Commissioner Michael Copps dissented from the decision in large part for this very reason.
Nothing in this order can rebut the simple truth that less competition equals higher prices. Indeed, when you step back and look at the totality of these proposed transactions, the direction here is unmistakable. This decision is about big media getting bigger, with consumers left holding the bag. My advice to consumers when they hear about the wonders of clustering and consolidation is to hold on to your pocketbooks. This is not a consumer-friendly transaction.
Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein also dissented in part because the FCC is not requiring Comcast and Time Warner to adhere to the principle of network neutrality, a condition placed on the mergers of AT&T with SBC and Verizon with MCI less than a year ago.
It was a major step back to let these large media conglomerates, including two of the nation's largest broadband providers, go even bigger without requiring that they comply with these basic network neutrality principles. We should be thinking about how to enhance our consumer protections in the broadband world, not to erode them.
Andrew J. Schwartzman, president and CEO of the Media Access Project, helped lead a campaign which resulted in nearly 30,000 public comments filed with the FCC questioning the implications of the Adelphia deal. He says he's pleased that the transaction was not simply rubber stamped, but he's very concerned about the lack of action on the issue of net neutrality.
We will see a less open and less free internet. That combined with the loss of competition and the increased rates that will come from that mean that in balance, this was an unfortunate transaction which the FCC approved.
A few months ago, the Media Access Project threatened a legal challenge to the FCC's decision if it did not fully address consumer concerns. Schwartzman says it's too early to tell whether such an action is still justified, but he's keeping his options open.
It's premature. This is going to be a lengthy decision, and the devil is always in the details.
In the short term, as for the customers of Comcast, Time Warner, and Adelphia, prepare for rising rates. Since 1996, cable rates have risen on average more than 60%.
Immigration may be shaping up to be an election year issue, but there's much more to the story than desires to beef up U.S. borders or deport millions of people. Deepa Fernandez, host of WBAI New York's morning program Wake Up Call, has been digging extensively into the business and politics of immigration for a book she's just published on the subject. She says media coverage of immigration is one-dimensional and lacks any historical context, like the fact that even harsher anti-immigrant legislation was debated in the House of Representatives last year, to which an amendment was offered that would have effectively declared open season on immigrants by bounty hunters. Fernandez covered that debate on Capitol Hill, along with other national correspondents, only one of which reported on it. Everybody else, she says, gave reasons for ignoring the story.
You know, I got told everything from my editor would edit it out. It's not the most important part of the bill. It's only an amendment. My audience is not interested in that.
Given this context, the immigration debate of today seems shallow and insubstantial. Fernandez says that's because much of the news taking place around the issue now happens nearly exclusively under the rubric of fighting terrorism.
But it's not actually doing anything to protect against terrorism, and you can even leave that aside. What it's doing is overwhelmingly building up a state apparatus where immigrants can be surveilled and monitored and arrested, jailed, and then deported.
Because immigrants who do not yet have citizenship status have limited rights under U.S. law, and they are some of the people most at risk by immigrant roundups conducted under the guise of anti-terrorism, Deepa Fernandez believes journalists have an obligation to help protect them from undue persecution. Her new book is entitled Targeted, National Security and the Business of Immigration, and is published by Seven Stories Press.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
You're listening to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now present the first of two features dedicated to the Israeli-Lebanese conflict of mid-July 2006. In this first feature, we'll hear from Lina Odeh, a student of Arabic from Chicago studying at American University in Beirut, who evacuated Lebanon to nearby Cyprus. The following phone interview was conducted by Chicago Indie Media's Rita Sand on Sunday, July 16, 2006.
Hello.
Hi, Lina?
Yes.
This is Rita Sand with Chicago Indie Media.
Okay, hi.
Hi. Is it okay to talk with you?
Yes, but we're supposed to be evacuating in the next 10 to 5 minutes. I'm not sure.
Okay. And I'm recording this.
And you called me earlier when they were hitting badly, weren't you?
Yes, and I'm terribly
okay,
sorry.
Okay. Oh, no, it's okay. I'm sorry. It's just, it was so bad because the whole building smelled all the smoke and see everything, so we were panicking a little bit.
What happened at that time?
I don't know. I guess they hit another port. The thing is, my dorm is right next to the beach. I used to, before this, walk to it, like a block at the most, because all you do is go around the corner, and you cross the street, and it's right there. And so we could see the sea. So the smoke, we couldn't see anything because the smoke was everywhere, because they had bombed the port, the Israelis did.
Where are you?
We're at AUB, the new women's dorm,
okay.
The American University of Beirut.
American University, and you're there for the summer, or you're there for how long?
I was doing a summer Arabic program, and then I was going to do a year study abroad here at AUB, just directly enrolled like an average student, just transferring credits to my home university.
Mm-hmm. And what are your plans right now?
Well, they're evacuating us to get out, pretty much. Hopefully, they're taking us to Cyprus, to Larnaca, and then... It's pretty booked there, but hopefully we'll be able to get back to the States soon.
I see. So right now you're waiting to be evacuated?
Yes.
Tell me what you have seen so far.
What haven't we seen? I mean, we're pretty, considering what most of the country's going through, we're pretty comfortable. But we've seen lots of the exchange. We've seen Hezbollah hit the Israeli ship. We've seen just them bombing the ports. That's most of what we've seen in terms of actually seeing. Other than that, we're not really seeing the same things that people in Al-Zahia, which is southern Beirut, and people in southern Lebanon are seeing. They're getting bombed and bombed. Every residential area, road, bridge, they're all bombing it. And people are just suffering. If you don't have a bomb shelter, it's pretty much, you know, it's a huge risk to even be sitting, you know, if you're in the south. So
you feel pretty safe where you are?
I feel okay, but... So hopefully we'll be leaving soon, in the next 10 minutes or so, but I feel fine. I mean, you know, we're privileged to have the American passport to an extent, because we get to leave, you know. Most of the people, you know, where do they go? They have to stay here and live through suffering and war. It's just not right.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the perspective of the people over there in Lebanon?
The Lebanese people?
Yes, the Lebanese people.
I mean, they have been wonderful with us. They are so concerned about the Americans and all the internationals here. They're so worried. They want us to get out safely, but they're going to be stuck here, you know? Their perspective is that they're just suffering. Their country is falling to pieces in front of them by Israel. They're afraid. They want to be able to live, and that's pretty much their perspective. It's not the same the way the American media is portraying it, that they're all extremists who want... you know, Hezbollah to succeed. Many of them are even upset with Hezbollah, although that may be, you know, another issue all in of itself. But, I mean, there's a recognition that the United States and Israel are working together and at the wrong in terms of not putting forth a ceasefire.
Mm-hmm. How do you think they feel about their government right now, the Lebanese government?
There's no Lebanese army. There's nothing. So, I mean, like, there's so much that the Lebanese government can do. I think that they're expecting their government to stand up and say, how dare you expect us to not be able to defend ourselves, because that's what the U.S. has been telling the Lebanese government to do. So I think people aren't even really thinking about that. I think they're more on a survival basis of what are we going to do today or tomorrow, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you'd think that they would not have the wherewithal to even deal with Hezbollah right now. The Lebanese government doesn't have
The Lebanese government has made it clear that they're working with them. It's not an issue of dealing with them. Israel's the one who's attacking them. Hezbollah is not even really doing anything. I mean, it's what? It's an organization. It's not a first world military power. So I think the Lebanese government is recognizing that Israel is hitting the airports, the ports, the bridges. It's not like they're hitting Hezbollah. They're hitting the country. So, I mean, it's in a full-on attack on Lebanon, not just Hezbollah. So everybody's in it together, essentially, to try to survive.
Mm-hmm. What would they like to see the U.S. government do?
To call a ceasefire, to stop funding Israel with weapons and $9 billion in our tax dollars going to bomb us while we're sitting here. You know, I think just for a ceasefire, they're not even asking them to support them in this situation, to say that they're with the Lebanese. They're just asking for them to ask for Israel to stop bombing.
What is the Lebanese government doing at this point? Do you know?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not watching the news. I don't know. I mean, we're just students who are here on our own without our families. First time I ever travel anywhere by myself. We just want to get out. We don't know what the political situation is. We don't know this or that. All we know is we want the violence to end. And if that requires, you know, political leverage to say, hey, call a ceasefire, then that's what it is. But in our eyes, it's just asking for some humanity.
Have you had basic supplies, food, electricity,
yes,
water?
Yeah, our generator has been working on, and it goes on and off, but for the most part, we've been okay, because it's the American University. But most people otherwise are not having that. There's a food shortage. Bread is short. There's not really any meat. Because Israel has blockaded the sea, so there's no imports coming in. People in the south, it's completely cut off from food. So people in the north are trying to make bread and send it to them because they don't have anything to eat.
Are most people still working at the university, whether through all this?
Not really working, more so just ensuring that we're okay. We see an administrator once in a while, but, you know, pretty much it's to ensure everybody's safety.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no classes, everything's canceled, so it's not like they're sitting there working on their research or teaching, so it's just more to ensure the safety of everybody.
So throughout, every part of the country has been disrupted.
Has been disrupted?
Yes.
I mean, I don't know about every part of the country. Definitely the south and southern Beirut is being obliterated. Northern parts have been hit, and along the Syrian border, it has all been hit. So, I mean, certain parts of the mountain may have not been touched yet, but they definitely hear the bombs and feel the planes. Okay, we're going.
All right.
I have to go.
Okay,
right.
Thank you so much, Lena.
Yep. Right, bye.
Bye-bye.
That was an interview by Chicago Indie Media's Rita Sand with Lena Ode, a student from Chicago studying in Lebanon before her evacuation from American University in Beirut. We next present an article by Larry C. Johnson, published on July 17, 2006, on the blog Boomin Tribune, online at boomintribune.com, spelled BOOMANTRIBUNE.com. The article was published elsewhere on the internet, including at alternet.org, and examines the situation going on in the Middle East from a wider perspective. Apparently not content to let the U.S. do a self-immolation act in the Middle East by itself, Israel decided to set itself on fire by invading Lebanon. Burn, baby, burn. Like George Bush, Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert never served in a combat unit, and launched military operations without thinking the matter through. In fact, Olmert reportedly never even served in the military. I raise this because there is one simple question Israel cannot answer about the current operations. What is their strategic military objective? Olmert has somehow persuaded the Israeli military to ignore strategy, think tactically, and in the process become really stupid. The events in the next several weeks will expose as myth the canard that you can secure a nation by killing terrorists. No, you can't. Killing terrorists has a place in policy, but it is not a strategic military objective. It is a tactical objective, and it may serve political purposes, but achieves little in terms of securing Israel. Israel is attacking targets in Lebanon like a drunken sailor in a bar fight, flailing about, causing significant damage, hitting innocent bystanders, and generally making a mess of things. This is not the Israeli military that pulled off the brilliant and daring raid at Entebbe. What about Hamas and Hezbollah? They are not terrorists. They carry out terrorist attacks, but they are not terrorists. They are something far more dangerous. They are a fully functioning political, social, religious, and military organizations that use terrorism tactics, but they are far more formidable than terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda or the Basque Terrorist Organization. They do have the resources and the personnel to project force, sustain operations, and cannot be easily defeated. Unlike the Egyptian and Syrian armies in 1973, Hamas and Hezbollah will not easily fold and cannot be defeated in a 7-day war. If that is the assumption among some Israeli military planners, it is a crazy fantasy. While most folks in the United States buy into the Hollywood storyline of poor little Israel fighting for its survival against big bad Muslims, the reality unfolding on our TV screen shows something else. Exodus, starring Paul Newman, is ancient history. Hamas and Hezbollah attacked military targets. Kidnapping soldiers on military patrols may be an act of war and a provocation, but it is not terrorism. And yes, Hezbollah and Hamas have carried out terrorist attacks in the past against Israeli civilians. I'm not ignoring those acts. I condemn them. But we need to understand what the dynamics are right now. Israel is not attacking the individuals who hit their soldiers. Israel is engaged in mass punishment. How did Israel respond? They bombed civilian targets and civilian infrastructure and have killed many civilians. Let's see if I have this right. The Arab terrorists attack military units, destroy at least one tank, and are therefore terrorists. Israel retaliates by launching aerial, naval, and artillery bombardments of civilian areas, and they are engaging in self-defense. If we are unable to recognize the hypocrisy of this construct, then we ourselves are so enveloped by propaganda and emotion that, like the Israelis, Hezbollah, and Hamas, we can't think rationally. We can only think in terms of tribalism and revenge. Iran, meanwhile, is sitting in the catbird seat. They have a well-trained and highly competent Surgen force in Hezbollah. Hezbollah's successful attack on Friday, July 13, 2006, on an Israeli naval vessel is a reminder that Hezbollah is not a bunch of crazy kids carrying RPGs and wearing flip-flops. I would be willing to wager that at least one Iranian military advisor was helping Hezbollah launch the missile that hit the Israeli ship. But Iran is doing much more than simply engage in tit-for-tat. They are thinking strategically. The events unfolding in Iraq and Lebanon are going Tehran's way. The United States is being portrayed in the world media as a government that tolerates and excuses attacks on civilian populations. The perception becomes the reality, and the ability of the United States to rally support among the Russians, the Chinese, and even the French becomes more impaired. We need the international community to deal effectively with nuclear proliferation in North Korea and Iran. Now, we will be bogged down trying to defend Israel from an angry international community. In the past, the United States has had enough credibility on both sides and kept enough of a distance during these blood feuds so that we could intervene and prevent the fighting from escalating into a gigantic war. It appears that there is no one in the Bush administration who can step up and intervene to calm the situation. Hell, with John Bolton and Elliot Abrams leading the charge, we are Israel's enablers. Former Senator Fred Thompson played a U.S. Navy admiral in the movie The Hunt for Red October. While speaking about escalating tensions as the United States and the Soviet Union chased a renegade submarine, he said, "This business will get out of control. It will get out of control, and we'll be lucky to live through it." Those words are relevant today. Let's hope and pray they don't come to pass. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.